It's a great pleasure to welcome to the conversation Mark Rubenstein, author of the terrific weekly newsletter on financial sector themes called Net Interest. Mark, today we'll talk about your article on Paytm from idea to IPO, which I thought was a great introduction to Paytm, but also to the payments landscape in India and the concept of pivoting as a startup.
Yeah, that's right, John. It's a fascinating concept, this idea that companies can shift direction. It's clearly prevalent in the startup scene. And actually, even amongst public companies, there have been some phenomenal examples of companies that have innovated new strategic directions. So Netflix is the most popular case study of that. Other companies have failed, Nokia, BlackBerry, for example. But Paytm is a company which unusually has pivoted a number of times. It's a 20-year-old company, founded in 2000 in India by Vijay Shekhar Sharma, VSS, they call him. He started it initially to do one thing, and then over the years, it has done various other things. It is now a all-singing, all-dancing financial institution that operates digitally, and it's readying itself for an IPO. It announced last week that it had received board approval to IPO, and we're expecting documents to come sometime over the next couple of months, with an IPO expected this year at supposedly, reportedly, $30 billion valuation.
And the idea of pivoting was popularized by Eric Ries in his book, The Lean Startup. And as you point out, Sharma, the founder of Paytm, hasn't written a book of his own, but he has tweeted quite a lot along the journey of Paytm. And I actually just followed him on Twitter, thanks to you. So I thought that was an interesting thing that we could kind of follow along that journey of Paytm in real time.
It's interesting, isn't it? The benefit of Twitter. He's been, actually, I don't know how long he's been on Twitter, but as you say, he's written 36,000 tweets. A lot of them actually geared towards customer service. He seems very accessible. He retweeted my piece. He shared my piece on Friday when it came out, which was very nice of him, and allowed me to pick up some more subscribers. But he hasn't written a book. He's been very active on Twitter, and it's a great way through history to understand some of the decisions he's made, strategic decisions he's made in operating Paytm from the very beginning.
So let's start at the beginning. I mean, how did his journey in entrepreneurship get started?
Well, so he attended college in India, in New Delhi. Story goes that he taught himself English prior to attending college, allegedly through listening to rock songs. He attended college in New Delhi, actually set up a business in his student days called Indiasite.net, which he was lucky enough to sell in 1999, before the peak of the dot-com boom, for $500,000. So that set him up financially. He tried a few other initiatives. And then in 2000, he, along with some others, he formed the company that still exists today called 197. 197 is the parent company of Paytm. Paytm itself didn't launch till much later. 197 initially was a mobile content company. They provided content to mobile operators that allowed the mobile customers to call into the operators. The number was 197 for information. This was in the era before smartphones. So if you were on the road and wanted to know the latest cricket score, for example, you could dial 197 and the operator would tell you that cricket score. You could dial 197 and listen to a song as well. Very, very early incarnation of Spotify. A song could be streamed over your mobile phone at your verbal request. All of that was provided to the mobile operators by 197, which was Sharma's company. Very, very successful, grew to be a very large business. The market grew to be worth $1 billion by 2006. But the company faced very stiff competition. Its market share slipped. Every year it had to renew its clients. And then one year it lost its biggest client in India and it was wiped out of the business. So Sharma was forced to pivot the company, which was his first pivot, which he did quite successfully.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing is he tweeted in 2014 about this, and he said, a team never gets stuck on a B-grade market. They switch, or fancy word, pivot. So he was very, very deliberate about that pivot that he was undertaking at the time.
Yeah, that's right. Now, by then, he'd built up a lot of data around customer activity. And so the pivot was towards a marketing business where they would sell leads to mobile phone companies, enabling them to cross-sell or upsell their customers. So one example is that he would be able to identify that a customer was receiving a lot of international calls, for example, but not making those calls. And so having identified that the customer had contacts outside of India, the mobile phone company would be able to ring up from a call center the customer and say, we know you're taking these calls from outside India. You're not making them. What if we offer you a contract, a special tariff, which enables you to make international calls at a cheaper rate? And so 197 identified these cross-sell opportunities and sold those leads to the mobile phone companies. That was also very successful. But yet again, it was a market that was ultimately squeezed. In 2009, 2010, the mobile phone companies realized they could do it themselves. Actually, there's something else I should say here, which is that one of the interesting things about pivoting is it's not necessarily the technology, it's not necessarily the idea, it's the business model around it. So various software companies, including some based in Europe, were able to sell similar systems to the Indian mobile phone operators, but they sold those systems at an enterprise level. And what 197 innovated was the idea that they could be paid on a lead basis. They were paid per successful cross sell. So it was the revenue model which was also differentiated, as well as the underlying pivot away from the content business that they'd been doing previously. That market got squeezed. Mobile companies realized they could do this themselves. And so one more time, he had to realign the business model again. And so that's what he started to do in 2010.
And then Paytm, I guess, came out of that, stands for Pay Through Mobile, where he was able to add a bunch of services that customers could pay for through their mobile phone.
Yeah, that's right. So at the time, and largely to this day, most mobile phones are in India are prepaid. So there's no monthly contract necessarily. They're largely preloaded. The way that was affected was customers would attend local distribution outlets of the mobile companies. They could be in small stores that weren't necessarily controlled by the mobile companies. They'd put down some cash and they'd get a top up. I think sometimes it's called recharge, sometimes it's called top up. They it was very cash. It was very labor intensive. It was very cash heavy. What Sharma introduced was a facility to pay directly via the mobile phone. So not that many people at the time had cards or facilities to pay with a credit card, but those that did would be able to set up a facility through Paytm on the mobile phone, which allowed them through a few clicks. So rather than walking in the humidity to the local store, through a few, or they could manage an entire family's top-up facility directly on a mobile phone. They could register, they could load the equivalent of a couple of dollars, and then that would be diverted to the mobile phone company, and the top-up would be affected. So that's basically what was introduced. Very simple system to top up, recharge mobile phone prepaid contracts via mobile phone. Hence, as you say, Paytm, pay through mobile.
And initially it was basically purely payments. The money didn't really stay in those Paytm wallets.
Exactly. Now, a byproduct was that in order to affect this, a mobile wallet was set up. So a mobile wallet was set up by Paytm. Initially, as you say, didn't have anything in it on a consistent basis because the equivalent of the $2 or $3 would come in and it would go straight out again. But it was recognized quite early that there was some potential to use that wallet for something more. And so initially, kind of in parallel to that, in addition to paying for mobile phone top-ups, some additional services were added. So digital satellite services, bus tickets, utility payments, and so on, typically kind of high frequency, low value transactions where paying via mobile was efficient. So that's what happened. But in addition, as you kind of previewed, the mobile phone wallet was set up as well. Now, in order to really utilize that and really capture the value that covered, he needed a license. And in 2014, the company got a license. There are three different types of mobile wallet license available in India. The central bank, the Reserve Bank of India, dishes them out. And what Paytm got in 2014 was a so-called semi-closed PPI, prepaid payment instrument license, semi-closed, which allowed them to use this wallet as a payments mechanism to do pretty much everything apart from withdraw cash. So a closed license would be very, very specific use cases. Semi-closed is what Paytm received. And then fully open would have allowed them to actually withdraw cash as well, which was the only restriction on the license that Paytm received. It used that license, and this was kind of, if you like, this was kind of the killer app. Used that license to negotiate a very interesting partnership with Uber. So previously, as I've indicated, most of the throughput was low value, high frequency transactions, and not that much money would be left on deposit, if you like, within the wallet. Uber came along into India and was confronted with a problem. Uber's problem was that credit card payments in India were mandated to have two-factor authentication. And that added some friction to the kind of Uber experience. It was very difficult for Uber to facilitate that. It added some friction to the experience. The loophole, if you like, was that if you paid using a digital wallet, that could go straight through. Wouldn't have to go through the two-factor authentication process, which made it much easier, much more beneficial for a Uber customer to use a wallet to pay rather than a credit card. And Paytm did a deal with Uber. And as a result of that, it was able to tap into a whole new demographic in India, which was the Uber customers. And that was typically higher value transactions. And also there was an incentive to leave money in the wallet in order to utilize Uber services as and when. And that was a big breakthrough, if you like, the killer app for Paytm.
And around that same time, meaning around 2014, came another big milestone for Paytm, resulting from Sharma's admiration for Jack Ma, and then he actually meeting with Ma in China.
Yeah, that's right. So he'd always, in fact, the evidence is there on his Twitter feed. He's got three kind of role models, actually, in the business community. One of them is Jack Ma. The other one is Son of SoftBank, and the third is Steve Jobs. Jack Ma, he'd admired him since 2011. He recalls vividly in interviews subsequently, he's talked about this, seeing him present at a conference in Hong Kong in 2011. In 2014, he needed to raise funds for Paytm, and he went to Alibaba HQ in Hangzhou in order to meet Jack Ma. Supposedly, 20 minutes were scheduled. Supposedly, they spoke for in excess of 2 hours. And he got the check. Ant/Alibaba invested in Paytm about $500 million, took a 25% stake. And subsequently, Alibaba or Ant had a very, very strong influence on the strategic direction of Paytm. So a couple of things. First one was the idea of e-commerce. So I've written about Ant before, and I think one of the kind of founding story of Ant as distinct from Alibaba is that Alipay, which Ant turned into, Alipay turned into Ant rather, Alipay was set up as a facility to facilitate e-commerce in China. There was various frictions involved with payments and receiving goods in parallel to those payments being made. And so an escrow facility was set up within Alipay, and digital payments were wrapped around that, which boosted very, very directly the amount of activity that Alibaba was able to do. So Alibaba came first, e-commerce came first, payments came second as a means to facilitate that and to remove some of the frictions. Obviously, in the case of Paytm, as we've discussed, the development was different. But there was a recognition that the e-commerce market was so large and would affect such incredible growth in payments that it was desirable to expand into e-commerce. And so as a result of that influence, Paytm set up its own marketplace. It added a number of merchants, and that 250 merchants, and that basically carried on. It's been rebranded since Paytm Mail was launched subsequently, but even to this day, most of Paytm's non-payments revenues come from e-commerce. They basically get a commission on the sale of every product that's conducted over the e-commerce platform. One other area of influence was in offline. So previously, everything was done digitally. It was all online. Clearly, it was the case then. It was the case before COVID. It's still the case today that most commerce happens offline. And previously, Sharma was very skeptical about moving Paytm to the offline market. He worried it would be a diversion of, it would be a distraction. He worried about the sales effort required in order to acquire all of the offline merchants. But he changed his mind. And the reason why he changed his mind, he did a trip to China, actually it was towards the end of 2015. So Alibaba Ant was already a shareholder of Paytm at that stage. He did a trip to China and he saw QR codes. He saw the way QR codes worked and he was converted. So he came back, he launched QR code offline payment functionality in India. By 1 year later, 1.5 million merchants were signed up. Actually, via Twitter, you can see a picture of the very first store that was QR code enabled in India, and that was September 2015. Today, that number is about 20 million. So today they've got 20 million offline merchants with full QR functionality. So both of these, the whole e-commerce initiative, online and then offline, emanated from the Jack Ma influence coming out of China.
Now, it's also interesting how the government, through its actions, can affect the market opportunity for Paytm. And here, the story seems to be twofold, where government action first benefited Paytm, but then the government introduced UPI, which was clearly a threat.
Exactly. Both happened in the same year. So 2016, very critical year for Indian payments. The government in November announced demonetization, removing all 500 and 1,000 rupee banknotes from circulation. About 4/5 of paper money was taken out of circulation almost overnight, led to cash shortages and demand for non-cash payment systems. So for Paytm, was a huge boon. They, going into that, they had 150 million or so users. And then within 6 weeks, they'd added another 20 million users to take them above, close to 180. So they had just over 150. They went close to 180 million over about 6 weeks subsequent to that. Big, big boon for them. That's the positive. The negative is that the government introduced new payment rails in India called UPI, the Unified Payments Interface. It is a fantastic case study in government intervention into payments. It's been cloned since in Brazil with the system there. And actually just recently, it's been announced that it's being looked at in Europe. The idea being that a open, universal digital payments facility should be introduced. In India's case, the catalyst was in order to allow more Indians to be banked. The number of unbanked Indians was very, very high going into this. And the government wanted to introduce a system whereby digital banking could be universally encouraged. The difference with the wallet is that the wallet is typically closed. So that, if you're looking at Cash App, which is run by Square in the United States, looking at Paytm pre-2016 and even post-2016 in India, looking at Alipay, these are all closed wallets, whereby they work only if the merchant and the customer is on the same system. What was introduced in India through UPI was an open interface where people could pay each other using all different variety of identifiers. It could be the mobile phone of the recipient, bank code, digital ID, which actually is something separate. We won't talk about it today, but something separate that was introduced in India. It could be the UPI identification code itself, could be a QR code, whatever. Very, very flexible payment system. And it was free. The system itself is owned collectively in partnership between the commercial banks and the central bank, the RBI, and it was free. That was introduced, and it initially, Paytm got involved. It launched a parallel service to its closed wallet service. So you could pay via Paytm or you could pay via UPI using Paytm. And it won a very high market share, but it became a very, very competitive market. Two players in particular, one of them owned by Walmart, PhonePe, one of them owned by Google, Google Pay, started to build up huge market share. They competed with cashbacks. So for every payment that was made, customers would receive a cashback. very, very heavy marketing as well. And it was kind of a race for market share. There was a land grab, huge land grab going on 2018, 2019 for UPI in India. Very interesting. Power law dynamics prevailed, as we've seen in other tech-enabled innovations elsewhere. And those players gained huge market share. So today, the Walmart-owned player has got 45% market share, and then Google Pay has got 34% market share. So huge, huge market share. So much so that the government has decided actually needs to do something about this. This isn't really helpful, and has imposed a cap on market shares of about 30% going forward. Paytm lost share and actually shifted its strategy away from the kind of peer-to-peer, which is the bulk of UPI payments, towards peer-to-merchant. And it's been quite successful there. It's got actually the highest market share from a recipient perspective, indicating that it has a lot of merchants on its platform, but has really been reduced its market share. It argues, and I'm sure some data will be forthcoming when it files for its IPO, it argues that its profitability per transaction over UPI is higher than those competitors. But that's basically what it's forced to do. So long story, government, and in answer to your question, gave Paytm a big boon through demonetization, but at the same time created additional competition in the digital wallet space through the launch of UPI.
And so, as you write, despite the rising penetration of digital payments, Paytm revenue growth has actually stagnated around 2% per year over the past few years, down from previously more than doubling annually. And I guess now it sounds like Paytm is pivoting toward becoming a full-service financial institution.
That's right. And actually, I would add to that financial data that you gave, I published on a Friday. On Saturday, the company then disclosed some more financial data, which showed actually revenues went backwards over their fiscal year 2021, which is the year ending end of March 2021. So adjusted, probably the growth in revenues could be even lower than that, but you've seen a massive deceleration in revenue growth over the past few years. Companies pivoting again towards full-scale financial services using payments. So right now, I mentioned earlier, most of its revenues come from payments, and those that don't come from payments comes from e-commerce. There is a very, very small wedge of other financial products that are in there, and that's the piece that they want to grow going forward. Not dissimilar to what Ant Financial did when it went into lending, insurance, mutual funds. Not dissimilar to what Tinkoff in Russia is doing, gone into retail brokerage, gone into e-commerce. Not dissimilar from what Nubank is doing in Brazil, or even what Square is doing in the US. There is a convergence of fintech business models increasingly towards, once you've got the attention of the consumer, you've got the real estate on the consumer's smartphone, why not cross-sell additional financial services to that consumer? Paytm Money was launched in 2018 to sell mutual funds. There's a special relationship Indians have with gold. And so a gold trading platform was launched at about the same time. Insurance as well has been launched, as has credit. What's interesting about credit is that, unlike in some of these other examples, not all of them, but some of them, they don't want to simply originate credit for third parties. And this is an issue that came to the fore in China, where the regulators required Ant ultimately to apply, to attach more capital to the credit they were taking on their own balance sheet. Paytm mentioned earlier, it's got this license, this payments license. It wants to upgrade that into a small finance bank license, which will allow it to take credit onto its own balance sheet. So ultimately, Paytm wants to become a bank, and the credit cross-sell will be partially credit that it will underwrite itself and retain on its own balance sheet. So all of these things going forward, and again, I'm sure we'll see more disclosure on this when they report their pre-IPO filings, we will see the ambition to grow revenues through the sale of these ancillary financial service products.
So, Mark, as we finish up, perhaps you can editorialize a little bit, because it seems the timing of the IPO is a bit curious, just given, you know, the revenue growth dynamics and the fact that this latest pivot really, you know, hasn't shown much fruit yet, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess from a valuation perspective, there's a lot of demand for payments oriented companies globally. This is looking to list in India rather than in New York, which will be interesting to watch. I think it's also interesting that it's going before Ant. Obviously, Ant was pulled. This will come probably October, November of this year, which would have been a year after Ant was meant to have been IPO'd. Some of the initial investors are looking to exit, so some of the proceeds will be secondary. The three biggest outside investors are Ant, SoftBank, and actually Berkshire Hathaway. Warren Buffett invested about $300 million in 2018. I think it was Todd Coombs who spotted Paytm, was introduced to it by a Goldman Sachs banker, and became quite interested in it. We're not sure at this stage if Berkshire is a seller or not at the IPO, but various reasons why the company might need more capital in order to invest in its financial services diversification strategy, but also why some of the early investors might want to be cashing out at this stage.
Very interesting. Well, Mark, thank you so much for the conversation. I guess I'll just mention at the end that Vijay Shekhar Sharma is on Twitter, and folks can follow him there. And I think that's a good way of following along Paytm's story.
That's right. That's right. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.